You're listening to Greater LA. I'm Saul Gonzalez, a public radio statewide show, The California Report, in for Steve Chiatakis. Homelessness is up across Los Angeles County again, actually for the fourth time in 5 years, which is bad news. But the news is not as bad as it could have been. At least that's how LA County and city officials are framing the results of this year's official homeless count that was released today. KCRW reporter Anna Scott, who covers homelessness, is here now to go through the results and what they mean. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Saul.
All right, so let's start with those numbers. More people are homeless. How many more?
This count finds there are just over 69,000 people living on the streets and in shelters throughout LA County, which is a huge number, obviously. It's not a lot different, though, from what we saw in 2020. This is a 4% increase since then. And within LA city limits, the increase is even smaller. It's less than 2%.
Okay, but so up 4% in the county as a whole since 2020. They skipped last year's count because of the pandemic. We should note that. Hey, an increase is obviously bad news, but it's a much smaller increase than in past years, right?
Yeah, if you just look at the previous 2 years before this two-year period. So if you look at 2018 to 2020, the numbers went up by double digits both of those years. Now we're seeing a 4% increase over 2 years. So the curve flattened. And LA does seem to be doing better than a lot of other counties in California this year. If you look at Alameda County, Sacramento County, San Diego County, they're all looking at double-digit jumps since 2020. So that is why LA city and county leaders today are saying, hey, this isn't good, but it's not that bad.
Okay, so fair enough. The numbers could have been worse. What do LA officials attribute the smaller increase to then?
They say it's because fewer people are falling into homelessness over the last couple of years, mostly because of one-time pandemic assistance. Things like increased unemployment, a freeze in rent increases on rent-controlled apartments in the city of LA, rental assistance, eviction moratoriums. Here's Molly Reisman, co-executive director of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, which conducts the count, talking about that.
If there's one thing you take away from these results, we want you to see how policy and investments matter. Tenant protections like eviction moratoria and rental assistance implemented by the county and city of LA help people stay in their homes and not fall into homelessness.
You'll notice that she's not talking about all of those ballot measures people are probably thinking of, like Prop Triple H, Measure H, that have put billions of dollars into fighting homelessness in LA. You and I have done some stories on those together.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just wanted to acknowledge that it's not that they aren't working, but they're not making the kind of difference that we can see yet in a point in time count.
So how do you know this? I mean, how do you measure the number of people who would have been homeless if not for these protections?
It has been an issue in Los Angeles for a long time that people are falling out of the housing market faster than the system can house them. And a few years ago, county officials actually put a number on this. They said that throughout the county, about 227 people become homeless every single day, but they can only house about 207. So about 20 people are falling through the cracks every single day. Molly Reisman from the Homeless Services Authority says that the number of people being housed hasn't changed that much over the last couple of years, so they attribute this smaller increase to fewer people becoming homeless.
Well, that's obviously a good thing, but aren't the pandemic programs like rental assistance and eviction moratoriums mostly either over or ending soon?
Yes, that is true. And I asked Molly Reisman from the Homeless Services Authority about this. I said, doesn't this mean that LA could soon be going off a big cliff? And she said, yeah, you're not missing anything. In the city of LA, officials are considering a plan to end COVID-19 protections against evictions and rent increases by January. And one person who's definitely not buying the official optimistic take on this year's numbers for that reason is Larry Gross. He's the executive director of the Coalition for Economic Survival, an organization that assists tenants who are struggling to pay rent. And he says all that pandemic relief has done in terms of homelessness in LA is kick the can down the road.
An increase is an increase. We should not be patting ourselves on the back for any type of increase in homelessness.
He also says his organization is already seeing an uptick in evictions, which is something I've heard from other advocates as well. So next year's homeless count could be bad.
So are there any proposals, Anna, on the table to keep the programs going that helped keep people housed, like from county supervisors, members of the city council, or the mayoral candidates?
Well, the short answer is no, there are no concrete proposals to keep those programs going. There are various groups advocating for different types of legislation at the state level, at the federal level. Backers certainly hope that these things could help, but we're going to have to wait and see.
And what about just, you know, the spectrum of other programs that have been launched? I'm thinking of things like Project Room Key. That's the one where unhoused people were placed in hotel and motel rooms during the pandemic. It's not permanent housing, but it got a lot of people indoors from outside. What impact did that have on these numbers?
It had an impact. The shelter system expanded a lot over the last couple of years. And even though homelessness increased overall, the number of people who are unsheltered, so just living on the street, not indoors, only went up by 1% in the whole county and actually went down a little bit in the city. So it's a little confusing. Homelessness is up, but the number of people who are living unsheltered and unhoused actually, you know, stayed flat or went down. That's not just because of Project Room Key. It's also because of other forms of shelter that, particularly in the city of LA, they've built up over the past couple of years. Tiny home villages, bridge home shelters. But Room Key was a really big one. It brought 10,000 people inside. Less than half of them have gone on to permanent housing, and that program is also ending. So we'll see in the end how many more people spill back onto the streets.
You know, just as a guy who does a fair amount of driving around LA and walking around LA, I'm surprised to hear that the number of unsheltered people didn't really change all that much and even went down, at least in the city of Los Angeles. Because I think a lot of people feel like there are just a lot more people out there camping on the streets, and you see them everywhere, right? From freeway off-ramps to back alleys to city streets.
Yeah, and you're not wrong about that. This is another strange thing about the count results. Even though the number of people camping on the streets didn't grow that much, the number of tents and vehicles and makeshift shelters went up by 17%. That's partly because for a while, at the beginning of the pandemic, the city and the county were allowing people in tents and in camps to shelter in place, which was in line with the Centers for Disease Control guidelines. They weren't doing big sanitation sweeps or enforcing rules about taking tents down during the day. Now, that has changed, especially in the city of LA, but people accumulated more belongings, put up more temporary shelters, and you're still seeing that today.
And finally, just a question about the count itself. You know, you talk to census experts and they will tell you an unsheltered population is an incredibly hard population to count accurately. So how accurate is this count?
This count has always been a lowball estimate at best. They only count people who fit the federal definition of homelessness. So people on the streets, people in shelters, not people who are couch surfing or in any number of other situations where they might be invisible but still unhoused. A few years ago, one county official told me that there's probably a couple hundred thousand people experiencing homelessness in LA at any given time. But most are able to pull themselves out of it without ever landing on the street or in a shelter or being counted as homeless. On top of that, the pandemic did make this year's count harder to pull off. So that is a lot of caveats. This is always a snapshot. That's why they call it the point in time count. But it's also the best indicator that we have in terms of getting a consistent picture on what is going on with homelessness.
All right. You have been listening to Anna Scott, who does extraordinary homelessness and housing reporting for KCRW. Follow all of her reporting on air and online. Anna, thanks so much for joining us on Greater LA.
Thank you, Saul.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
And back now with more Greater LA, I'm Saul Gonzalez. Let's turn to the performing arts. Starting today, a dance performance that's really way more than a dance performance is making its world premiere on and around the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. Some of it will sound like this. The show is called Being Future Being. It combines immersive dance, performance, conversation, ceremony, and many other things. And it's all from the perspective of an Indigenous artist who struggles with the relationship between people and the land they live on. Its creator, Emily Johnson, is here to talk to us about it. So, Emily, tell me about the performance.
Let's see. I am a dancer. I am a gatherer, I think, of people and ideas and intentions. When I am making performance and when we are performing, we and I are thinking of the land that we are on. So even if we are on a stage or indoors, for example, we are thinking of our relationship and responsibility to the land. And to us, that also means the land and the water and the people whose land this is, as well as the people who currently live on this land, as well as our more than human kin. And so to start with that very broad and maybe larger intention of performing, right? This performance moment to me is very vital. It's an invitation. It's an invitation for an audience to gather with us for a short bit of time. And what I'm interested in is, in that short bit of time, what might be either the questions or the provocations or the ideas that through the performance are kind of brought out into the space and perhaps into people's minds. So audience arrives and we have this time together. And then what?
And then what? And yeah. So are you trying to tear down that wall between performer and audience member?
We are actually trying to tear down all the walls, okay. All of the structures. To me, I think of, so there's a dance that I do where I ask people to close their eyes. We could do it right here in the studio if we wanted to. We close our eyes. We feel this floor that's holding us up. You know, I'm currently seated in a chair, so I can feel this chair. I can feel the floor.
As am I.
Yeah. And then through this dance, we would kind of go through feeling the other structures of this building, right? Maybe there's concrete, maybe there's wood, maybe there's some electrical wiring, you know, maybe there's some other material here in this building. And eventually we would get to the ground beneath us, right? And so I think of these structures, like these buildings, for example, as permeable and as not quite as permanent as we tend to think of them. And then I extend that thinking onto other structures, colonial structures, for example, or consistent systems of harm and injustice that are ever present, you know, but that I believe and I think that with the right attention and intention and will and hope that a lot of us have in the world, that we can change those systems of harm and those colonial structures. So partly that taking down the walls is also like, all right, let's take down the harmful colonial structures imposed upon this land.
So that's pretty heady stuff.
Yes.
So how do you do all of that in the movement of bodies? And explain it to someone like me, who is a non-choreographer, who has often some troubles at times wrapping his head around dance performances. How do you do that?
Well, it's heady, but it's also body, right? Like everything that I just spoke of and everything, and even the action of speaking, the action of moving, the action of breathing, the action of being comes from our bodies. So everything that I speak of and everything that we intend through this work is also from the body and body base.
I'll just note that you grew up in Alaska. You're a member of the Yupik Nation. How does that inform your work and how does that inform your relationship with the landscape that we've talked so much about?
I grew up in the woods. I grew up on Denaina land, which is down on the Kenai Peninsula. So I was often alone and playing in the in the woods. And I can, like, my face is just kind of very big with a smile right now because that that memory is so, I don't know why the word delicate comes to mind, but it's a very delicate memory and it's a very strong memory at the same time. And a lot of that time was with the trees in those woods. And even the first time that I recognized I was dancing, I was very small. And I was with a tree and I had my arms like wrapped around a tree and my feet were on the ground and I could like sense or feel the roots underneath the ground. And my body was pressed up to the tree and I was looking up. And so I could see the branches swaying above me. And I remember just like feeling all of that and thinking, oh, I'm dancing with the tree, you know, and it was something that as a kid, I experienced. And it had a pretty big, I mean, obviously, I think it had a pretty big impact on me. And it just came through my time in with the tree.
And does that carry on until today?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yes.
All right, Emily Johnson, you've given me and the audience a lot to think about. Thank you so much. And I really appreciate you joining us here on Greater LA.
Kwiana, thank you so much.
The world premiere of Being Future Being runs from today through Sunday the 10th at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. You can find out more details on our website. Go to kcrw.com/GLA. Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez in for Steve Chiatakis. Pop-up restaurants are everywhere in Los Angeles these days. They really took off during the pandemic, offering chefs a way to cut down on overhead costs while creating one-of-a-kind eating experiences. But selling homemade food has long been a way for aspiring LA chefs to make a name for themselves. Case in point, Trap Kitchen, the soul food startup launched by Malachi Spank Jenkins and Roberto New Smith in 2013. The two went from selling soul food plates out of their grandmother's kitchen in Compton to running a multi-city operation with a massive fan base. They also just released a new cookbook. Eater LA reporter and GLA contributor Mona Holmes spoke to the pair recently and is here to tell us more. Hey, Mona.
Hi.
And let's just set the table here briefly. Remind us, when we say pop-up, what are we talking about?
Pop-ups are a temporary restaurant that can be in any type of space. Oftentimes, they take up a space that is closed at a specific hour at a restaurant. Sometimes they are actually at an open restaurant where they have a series of temporary restaurants that set up space for people in Los Angeles to come and try different foods. So it's they've exploded over the last 2 years because of the pandemic. But Los Angeles has a long history that goes back as early as 2007, 2008, with pop-up kitchens that have really changed things.
And the Trap Kitchen guys were really ahead of the curve, right? Going back to 2013, what did they do?
These are two guys, former gangbangers, one a Crip, one a Blood, who knew that they first didn't like each other. They became friends. And because of that, were able to put a pop-up in Roberto's grandmother's house and just decided to sell really soulful food and develop this massive fan base when Instagram was still fairly young in 2012, 2013. And it got so popular that the demand just surged that they would sell out of food, have to literally run back to the grocery store. And now it's this multi-city business where there's some food trucks, there's a brick and mortar in Portland. I believe they have three or four in Los Angeles. They set up every week in Miami. They've proven to be a long-term business that's successful.
And did they create a model that others then followed? Did other people looking to start a pop-up look at their experience and say, we're going to do what those guys did?
I would, although Los Angeles does have even South LA has a very long history of pop-ups turning into successful business. And I would say that probably one of the originators is Lovey Yancey, who started Fat Burger way back in the 40s. And, you know, but the ones that come to my mind most are the All Flavor No Grease, Keith Garrett, who started his in his front yard. And there's also folks like Blue Kitchen and also Taco Mel. Jermel Henderson is the owner of Taco Mel, who has a successful business right in Leimert Park, right on the border of Crenshaw, who's doing some amazing things with food and is likely going to open up a new location very soon.
And whether it's the Trap Kitchen guys or these other people you mentioned, what do pop-up chefs and entrepreneurs have to do or think about that the owners of a physical restaurant don't?
They have to really figure out how to connect with their customer base really quickly. They've got to get some great pictures up, you know, and also talk in a language of the people that are craving their food. It also helps that these two guys are of the community that they were serving and knew people personally, you know, would invite them, would talk to them, you know, create a personal connection with the people that some people that they grew up with or some people that they eventually became friends with. And, you know, and from what Malachi told me, and both Roberto mentioned in an interview a few months ago, is that, you know, it was just a place for people to come and get something to eat that they didn't necessarily have in their neighborhood. And so they were serving the needs of a neighborhood in the best way possible.
And just generally speaking, looking ahead beyond the Trap Kitchen guys, now that the pandemic is waning and restaurants are filling up again with customers, where do you think the pop-up model goes now?
You know, I am still trying to figure that out. Okay. You know, it's an interesting time right now. This is a typically slow era or a slow period for restaurants, right at the end of summer, beginning of fall, where demand tends to drop off as children go back to school and people go back to work after the holiday weekend. And so it's hard to determine that. However, I still see some pop-ups in the city that are doing really great things and opening up a brick and mortar like Julia Lord is you know, doing amazing things on Melrose with his new space. You know, there are so many that are trying to make that leap into a brick and mortar space, and others just want to continue with this path that doesn't have huge overhead, doesn't have high rent, you know, makes it possible for them to skip a week without having to rely on those huge, heavy expenses. So I absolutely would not say that it's about to disappear because it's just too big now.
And just finally and briefly, what's next for Trap Kitchen itself?
I highly recommend following their Instagram feed. First off, it's fascinating. It's entertaining. These guys travel a lot. These guys are obsessed with food. They are very clear and very open about sharing their next business venture. So I would just give them a follow on Instagram and see what they're up to next.
That is Mona Holmes, reporter for Eater LA and a regular contributor here on Greater LA. Mona, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Saul.
And that's our show for today. Next week, we'll explore plans to reform LA's criminal justice system for youths. Can we keep people out of prison in the future by treating them more humanely now? That's next week on Greater LA. You got feedbacks? You got comments? Well, then go to kcrw.com/AskGreaterLA and leave them. And while you're at it, think about subscribing to the podcast. You can do that there, too. Who made this show happen? Well, Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Sue Margulies, Amy Tan, and Christine Comito. Next week, Steve Chiatakis is back in the chair, no doubt rested and recharged. I'm Saul Gonzalez from the California Report. Thanks so much for listening.